You've landed inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
Well, good morning, Launch Street. Tamara here. You know, I'm sitting here. It's 6 o'clock in the morning, and I'm prepping for a day of interviews. And I'm wondering, who would you want me to invite onto the show? Maybe it's the author of an awesome book you just read or someone you follow in your work. If you have someone, let me know. I'd love to know who would float your boat and add a ton of value for all of us. Just shoot me an email or go on to Facebook or LinkedIn or wherever we are. Tell us who you think we should interview over here at Inside Launch Street. Now let's get to today's interview because it's a good one. I interview Marcin Klasinski. He caught the innovator bug at age 14, can get this, after infecting his shared family computer with a virus while trying to download video games from the internet. How many of us did that as kids? I know I did. That was the age that I grew up in. But here's what he did. Unable to remove the virus using traditional tools, Marcin turned to an online community and spent like a user group and spent the next 3 days asking questions and learning himself how to fix the problem with a computer book for dummies and the answers to his questions. Now, fast forward 4 years later, and while pursuing a college degree in computer science, Marcin founded Malwarebytes, a company dedicated to helping consumers get rid of hard to clean computer viruses, malware and adware. So his company is thriving because of his unique culture and focus on innovation. And keep in mind that he's in, let's call it cybersecurity, right? Like internet security, whatever you want to call it. That's a rapidly changing tech-driven industry. But I think you'll, as you'll hear in this interview, the way he thinks about staying ahead in a changing environment, the way he thinks about the focus on culture really is valuable to all of us. So let's listen in how he innovates in an ever-changing industry and how you can apply that to your world. Marcin, thank you so much for joining me today. We have so much to talk about.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right. What's your first memory of being innovative?
Well, I guess it ties back to the founding story behind Malwarebytes. And I loved video games. I loved pirating video games. We didn't have the money as a family to buy me those video games. So I had to get them in a maybe dubious way. And one day I just downloaded this video game off the internet and pop-ups are coming up. And this is when viruses were still kind of, I guess, boring, right? A purple gorilla jumping around your screen trying to sell you stuff. Today, we're talking about much more, as you know, much more sophisticated actors.
Yeah.
But the virus infects the family computer. I don't know what to do. My mom's screaming at me. She's hollering, you know, get this thing fixed. So I go on kind of Google and search for my symptoms. And so I find a message board of just wonderful people out there, superheroes, I call them today. And they help me get the malware off of my computer. And I decide, you know, these people are great and I want to become like them. So I'm going to start building cool applications, cool free tools to help them do that. And I really think that was my first kind of creative and innovative instinct is to help these people. And that's really how the company was founded.
So wait, let me get it right. So you pirated into the software, which gave you a virus, and then you had to fix the virus on your family computer. I'm assuming you actually fixed it.
Yeah, it took like 3 days, but eventually after, you know, these people helped me out, I followed all their instructions and I said, you know, to heck with this. I'm going to help them try to make this faster. And I want to become a superhero like them. So really that's the founding story.
And how, do you want me to ask you, how old were you when that happened?
15. So I've been doing this literally half my life now.
So that's amazing to me that a scenario like that. And, you know, I think we always think of coding, computers, virus, all that, like so scary for most of us that the fact that you were willing to dig in and kind of figure it all out is pretty impressive.
Well, here's a secret. I used one of those yellow for dummies books.
So they are handy.
Exactly. No regrets here.
Oh my God, that's funny. Well, so thank you for sharing that because that is, it is not only interesting, but as you kind of said, it kind of leads up to your career and what you've done. Before we kind of dig into Malwarebytes and the innovation that led to that, I just want to get us all on the same page. Because I think we hear the word cybersecurity a lot. You know, we hear it on the news, we hear it in business, but most of us aren't in it. So what does that even mean to be in that business? Let's start there before we go further.
Well, it's an interesting business, and there's a lot of aspects of it, and it's changed considerably in the last 15 years. You know, I joke about how pathetic some of the early viruses and things that were really scary actually were. I mean, truly, there were purple gorillas that were, you know, called malware back in the day. Today, we're talking about very sophisticated threat actors, and not all the time. You know, a lot of the malware that's out there is very generic and just looking for your Dropbox username and password or your bank account information. But there are, you know, software's become weaponized. There's some really scary stuff going out there where cities are being taken down by ransomware attacks. We're talking about airlines being taken down by ransomware attacks. So the world has truly evolved, and it's a cat and mouse game, because at the end of the day, the defender has to be right 100% of the time. The attacker only has to be right once. And so that's really, you know, the name of the game, and cybersecurity is affecting everybody's lives today.
So here's my question to you, because just on the outside looking in, and you alluded to it just now, cybersecurity, I'm guessing, right, is changing constantly. So how do you think about keeping up with it and staying a leader in an industry that's constantly changing?
Not only changing, but also expanding in breadth. So think of the internet connected devices that we have today that we didn't have 5 years ago. You know, your Nest device, your refrigerator for whatever reason, your Barbie doll for whatever reason,
right,
is connected to the internet. And that's a pretty broad set of topics to have to cover from a security perspective. You know, there's what we do, which is endpoint security. So basically protecting the devices, the endpoints, the devices that you carry in your pocket and your backpack that sit on your desk. But there's a plethora of other kind of attack vectors. You know, there's servers, you know, cloud-based systems. There's, we talked about thermostats. Now cars are internet connected. I mean, everything we touch is becoming internet connected and a risk. And that's what really cybersecurity is about, is mitigating that risk. And Malwarebytes, I really focused on, you know, the devices that we carry around and trying to do that very, very well for our customers.
So your company, Malwarebytes, has been recognized for being extremely innovative. So will you describe the innovation that has led to the development of the company and what you do?
Sure. I think I can answer that in two ways. One is really back to the founding story, and the second is what we do today. So let's start with the founding story. Yeah. We really saw the problem. Traditional antivirus, think Symantec, think McAfee, home brand names that everybody's really heard of. I had one of those. I was paying for it. I still got infected. And I met
think
my
most
co-founder.
Of us have that experience. We were like, what the hell?
Even to this day, right? Yeah. And so my co-founder, who also worked at a tech repair shop like a Geek Squad, would see all of these computers coming in. They were all protected with antivirus, and they were all infected. And so we really had to reinvent the way we were going to detect, you know, things that were malicious. And it was two guys against the world. And these other companies had just hundreds of people on the innovation side. We had just us. So we had to really rethink how we're going to detect. And two outside folks who really didn't have much cybersecurity experience, I think, were perfect for that challenge. So we looked at the threats that were actually affecting our users and focused on those threats. And so, and I'll give you some history. The way viruses were detected in the past was you had to see the virus first. You had to fingerprint it.
So you had to have it first.
Yeah. What's the point of that? you're reacting, right?
Yeah.
Today, these things are so polymorphic, meaning that you and I go to the same website, get infected, and we have two very different strains of the virus. So the world has changed considerably, and I think we had just a fresh, starry-eyed perspective, and we were able to hack this thing together and hire really smart people that, you know, really took a different look at the world.
And I was going to ask you a quick question on what you just said, because you said it quickly, but I think it's important. You basically said that you focused on the viruses or the threats that your customers had. I think that that's a really important point for all of us on Launch Street to really recognize. A lot of that great innovation and meaningful products and services really come from putting the customer first versus the other way around. And when you started to talk about the kind of old options of virus detection, it was kind of it was almost a technical approach to dealing with it versus a customer approach to dealing with it. I don't know if that's how you saw, but as you were talking, that's how I heard the difference between kind of what was out there and what you were trying to do.
Well, I think there's a very safe mentality in this industry, which is we've always done it this way, therefore it's going to work. And that's just not how the world works, especially when it comes to cyber criminals trying to play a cat and mouse game. So, I think, you know, that was certainly, we took a very different approach to detecting this stuff. And I actually, funny story, I read the book Crossing the Chasm about a year or two ago. So I'm well behind on my reading, obviously. and it talks about, you know, how great companies get started, and they pick a group of champions, people that are just, you know, going to help them build a great product. And for me, it was those superheroes. So consider this, right? I go on this message board, and this person helps me with a 30-page pamphlet, and she says, here's what you need to do to get healthy again. I built the software for them so that they can help people like me down the road. And what ended up happening is focusing on those champions, those technical people that knew what they needed, and building the product for them, they then proliferated it to hundreds of people each. So I read the book Crossing the Chasm. I'm like, oh, well, that's why we're successful. That was many, many years later.
You know, it's interesting. I just was having a conversation with someone about network science, meaning we no longer live in a hierarchical environment. We live in a network environment. And the key to the network is having a lot of loose connections who ultimately then turn into advocates, and serving them being your focus. And then they tell two friends and they tell two friends, right? And then you've got all the people on the screen. But it's interesting to hear you say that, because ultimately, what you did was A, put the customer first, but B, tapped into a network versus that hierarchical approach to kind of product launch.
Absolutely. I mean, traditional sales and marketing just don't necessarily work anymore. You need that virality. You need that word of mouth. You need those champions. And that's how great businesses get built today.
Yeah. So sorry, I interrupted. You were saying, and now today. So keep going. That was yeah, a great tangent, but it was a good one.
Great point. So today, you know, how do you keep that innovation going? How do we make sure that we're not stuck in the same ways? And so one of the things that we did is, and many other companies are doing this, you know, Microsoft has their garage. It's kind of a skunk works project. We call it Idea Bytes. Terrible name, maybe, maybe not. But the ability for our company, our people, to submit ideas that they think can A, benefit our customers, but also even innovate internally, meaning maybe we're just stuck with some bad processes that you see that we should just be spending time on. And so there's great prizes around that. And there's been some really great ideas that have come out of that that lab, some of our best ideas, in fact. So really trying to keep that culture of innovation is really important. Otherwise, we're just going to go the same way a lot of those traditional antivirus companies went.
Yeah, I mean, I think you couldn't be more right about that, that you have to continue to lead in the industry, especially given what you said earlier, right? You've constantly got changing threats. Your threat doesn't stay the same. Your competition doesn't stay the same. When you talk about your Idea Bytes, I like the name, by the way. It's funny. So I like it. But who's involved in that? Is everybody in the company involved in that? I'm just trying to think tactically, like, how do you think about, if I'm listening to this, how do I think about making sure that I've got people engaged in the process of innovation?
Well, the idea spawned from, again, Microsoft Garage. You know, Google encourages people to spend 10, 20% of their time innovating. And so we saw that as a need for the company. How do we keep 5 years ahead? So we really opened it up to the whole company. We almost have 800 people. So you have 800 people, incredibly talented, incredibly smart people. And yes, they're working on their day jobs, but they see in the peripherals everything else going inside the organization. They touch customers. They handle support tickets. They know what our customers need better than I even do, because, you know, I see things from a view, and they see it in the weeds. So encouraging them to submit ideas, you know, the best way to do it is more formally. So we created this program, and it's currently once a year, but we're trying to expand that. And we have hundreds of ideas submitted every year, and then whittle it down into really four categories: kind of internal innovation, external innovation, and so on. And actually, in just a couple of weeks, we're having our demo day here, where we've picked 16 teams to present, and the company actually, and executives as well, but the company really votes for their favorite idea that we should implement in the organization. And that person wins a prize and gets to be the champion of that idea and really drive that innovation.
So there's two things I want to kind of dig a little bit deeper on with you. First of all, I'm so glad that you said that everybody in your company is involved, because I was cringing a little bit waiting for the, we have a team of six, which drives me nuts, because I just don't understand why you would only tap, you know, the potential of six people in your company if you have 800. So I'm glad you said that. I had a moment of like, am I going to be arguing with him or agreeing with him? We'll see what happens. And neither is fine. But I do think that's critical to success of innovation in a company. But the second part of that I want to ask more about too is your kind of Shark Tank style approach to moving innovation forward. Kind of why, from your perspective, you think that works, and what you've actually as a company gotten out of it.
So with regards to kind of the first question, you know, we have a good set of people that actually submit ideas. So you have your VPs who have been here quite some time, and even new individual contributors who are like, hey, I've been here 3 months. Here's what I see as a need. So it's actually pretty interesting to see that it's not just a set of group or set of people, you know, whether it's just from engineering or just from sales or just from marketing. It actually does become pretty spread out, which is great. I like the Shark Tank approach today. Is that the right one? I don't know. Right. We're still figuring this out. It's our second year doing so. Last year, you know, to your point, it was really just kind of executives judging, and that wasn't really the right answer. So this year we have more of the employee base actually voting on their favorite ideas, and the Shark Tank kind of approach lets us, you know, let's people come up and defend their thesis. Here's why I think this is really important for the business. And it puts some formality around it, which is pretty cool. But is that something for the long term? You know, I don't know. We're still testing.
Well, and I think, yeah. And I, first of all, I love that. That's your experiential side, by the way, just for listeners. Marcin is an instinctual experiential, and I'm also an experiential, and our constant need to like, well, let's see where the rubber meets the road, because that's how we innovate, is by doing. So it's fun to hear you say that and talk about you actually have taken that and implemented it in the company with this process. But, you know, one of the things kind of you were just talking about is that everybody votes and kind of everyone has a say, and, you know, people have to get up there and defend their thesis. I think it does a couple things. One is it forces you to really put your best ideas and best foot forward. So, I mean, a quantity of ideas is awesome, but there's always some that people have a lot of passion, not just passion about, but reason for. And those tend to rise to the top when you have to invest your time and energy in presenting it. And the other ones tend to fall away. And I really love that. And I also think, too, that the idea of voting across the company allows you to see where maybe some of the hiccups down the road might be. Like maybe the R&D team doesn't like it for some reason, or maybe the customer service people see an opportunity that they didn't think of before because of the idea. So I think keeping it out of the exclusivity of leadership and into the entire company gives you a broader perspective and helps you see the impact.
Well, absolutely. And where my eyes open up is when I vote against the population. What am I missing? What am I missing, right, as the leader?
Do you have any examples of that? I'd love to hear what's come out of that.
Oh, I'm sure there are plenty. I can't recall off the top of my head, but you know, as we go into this cycle of Idea Bites, I am absolutely certain that there's going to be a fan favorite that maybe I don't understand, or I don't really understand the need for, because I'm not at the front lines all the time, right?
So, right.
And especially ones around customer focus. Even though I talk to, you know, a lot of large customers for us, there's a ton of small customers for us too, where you have support organizations, you know, touching them on a daily basis, and then internal processes. You know, I have to disconnect myself from the illusion that everything works so swimmingly when I'm involved, right? Because I get a different treatment. and I've seen this, right? So I think we need to go hire this person. The path gets cleared so quickly, but when somebody else, a hiring manager, needs to hire somebody, do we run into roadblocks? Do we need everything defined all ahead of time? And are we really slow? So that's the kind of stuff that I think opens up my eyes, is when the population votes in a very different direction than I would have voted. Let's take a look at that. What's actually going on there?
Right. That's really interesting. I hadn't really thought about that. You're right. And that happens to me with my team all the time, where I say something and all of them are like, no, wait, what? What's that? Hold on. What's happening? But the holes that they see that I didn't are because of what you said earlier. They're actually in some ways more in touch with our customer than I am, because they're talking to them on a daily basis. Yeah. Yeah. That's a nice way to say it. It's humbling. I'm curious how you think about or prioritize internal versus external innovation. I think both are important, and I'm always curious how people prioritize that, because I think oftentimes it's very easy to focus only on the external ones, because it's, I think, a little bit more tangible in some ways.
Boy, that's a tough one. And I think it's a matter of prioritization as well. You know, every idea should have merit, and we should flesh it out. So whether it comes from a customer directly or it comes from a team internally, I think it should get the light of day. I've had a lot of great ideas come from customers. You know, they feel the pain directly. And we as a team also need to kind of level set, we're not at the front lines of fighting the threats in their organization. So what are their organizational needs? Mm. And once we hear it from multiple customers, I think real work needs to get put in there. And I always encourage people to get on the phone with customers. And sometimes that's like pulling teeth. But they are, you know, the source of truth. That's what's happening to the world. That's what's happening with our products. At the same time, internally, you know, there's a lot of time wasted with just I don't want to use the word bureaucracy, not to think that we don't have it, but, you know, we try to fight it. But there's processes that just don't make sense. There's, you know, even for our customers, the way they sign up or the way they might have to go through 10 screens to accomplish a task. Sometimes it's just obvious and we see it and we should address it. So, again, it's a really balanced approach. I think getting somebody on the product team that knows how to prioritize internal and external against what the path forward is, I think is really important.
You know, it's funny. Just the other day, I went through a purchase cycle in my own company to buy the assessment online. And I realized all the problems. But it's amazing how little time we spend kind of walking in our customer shoes. And the innovation that can come out of, if you just take a step out of your job and into their shoes, how much you see for improvement.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, sometimes I think we should do more. I guess I always think we should do more.
Yeah. How do you think about continuing to lead in such a crowded industry? I mean, it's, correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels like a cybersecurity company is popping up every day. Now it's like the hot thing to do. So how do you continue to rise above given just the incredible clutter that's going on?
I'd say there's a few thousand cybersecurity companies. There's a massive event here in San Francisco called RSA, and it's an annual cybersecurity event. And I think there's thousands of vendors that attend every year. So it is a crowded market. And in fact, endpoint security, so the you know, protecting the devices that we all hold and use, that I can name probably 80 direct competitors, 80. So it is a crowded market and it's very difficult to differentiate. I'm not a big fan of marketing, meaning I think there's a huge importance in the organization on that, but we shouldn't leverage just marketing to make a difference. And so one of our, you know, core values is really innovation and investment into research and development. One of our core pillars is best research and development. So really focusing on that, because at the end of the day, if the product is the best, you know, people will use it. And marketing should support that messaging and that pillar. So how do we differentiate? Well, one thing that we do that other vendors don't is fix the problem. And it goes back to when I founded the company 15 years
ago.
Sounds
so obvious.
It sounds so obvious. We are the only company that does remediation the right way, meaning actually fully, completely removes the infection from the computer. Mm-hmm. And the value proposition after that is pretty simple. Like, hey, you had Symantec or McAfee or some other vendor, and we just cleaned up an infection and saved your bacon. And we did it for free. We don't mind doing that because it is truly a save the world kind of thing. I said nobody will ever feel this way ever again when I was infected, and I mean that to this day. But B, it's an incredible lead gen tool for us. You know, these people go to work, they have similar challenges, they need it for the organization. So the business model in itself is unique, and we really go after the threats that are impacting our customers. And we have all this threat telemetry and we chase the problems that matter for our customers and not just go up there and say, we do artificial intelligence and that's why we're better. We put our money where our mouth is and say, take the challenge. We will show you what's wrong with your desktop or laptop.
So are you, excuse me if this sounds a little bit naive, but it sounds like you're saying, so the other, if in terms of how you differentiate, the other companies, providers out there in cybersecurity in your endpoint area in particular are really doing a very traditional approach, which is what, marketing to get to new business, to get to the big sale. And what you're saying is, no, we know our stuff is so good that our approach is going to be, why don't you sample it basically? And then we can have a conversation.
That's right. And at the end of the day, no threat protection is 100%. You know, as we discussed earlier, the attacker only needs to be right once. So many of these endpoint providers, they do blocking. And when a threat gets through, you know, they shrug their shoulders and say, sorry, that's just what we sell you. So the ability to fix the problem either first, you know, then that's our entry point. That's our Trojan horse into any home user's computer or any business all over the world. We don't take that traditional approach. We say, listen, we will protect you. And when we can't, we're going to fix it for you. And we can layer on with another antivirus if that's what you really want. and together we can solve the problem for you. So it's just a unique business model. And the free remediation, you know, anybody that's listening right now can just go download our product and assess their computer for free and fix the problem for free. And I'm willing to bet you're going to go, wow, how did that get through? I better pay for Malwarebytes. And right. It's, you know, that happens quite a bit.
Well, and what I'm intrigued by with what you're saying, which I think for all of us on Launch Street is an really where we need to think about opportunities to innovate, is when you talk about the other, what are the other two big ones you mentioned? Is it McAfee?
Yeah, McAfee, right? Symantec.
McAfee.
Yeah, tons of them.
Right. And those viruses still get through. We shrug our shoulders and go, it's a frustration you have to deal with. And I think it's in those moments that companies like yours and great innovation overall are found, because it's not something we should have to just deal with. We just don't know that there's a better alternative out there, or we need to create that alternative, which is ultimately what you did.
Totally. And I actually think one thing to call out is the freemium model is phenomenal for that. The ability to just offer a taste to the customer saying, look, here's the value we can bring. And remediation is a huge value for our customer, for our users who ultimately become customers. And so we give that away for free. And, you know, yeah, there's hundreds of millions of users and only maybe 1% will convert, but that's a pretty great demand gen strategy. So I'm a big fan of freemium. Give something out for free, people will come.
And to with that many people taking it, you really do have great tested, proven software, right? It's not, I mean, millions, if millions of people have done it, you might have a handful of customers on the bigger scale, but that's still proof. That's proof of concept.
Exactly. Those are the good consequences, is, you know, the data that helps you make even better decisions for users. It's a flywheel. It's a circle, right?
So I want to go back quickly to your culture, because you talked about the Shark Tank style thing, and that kind of you've got this idea bites where people can contribute ideas and innovation and, you know, see if they go forward. One of the reasons I wanted to talk to you is you have a pretty unique culture, I'd say, particularly for someone in a tech industry. Tell me a little bit more about why your culture is so unique and how you think that's actually contributed to the bottom line.
So I would say our culture is incredibly open and transparent. I mean, down to the desks. We don't have offices. I don't sit in an office. I'm sitting with engineering today. I sat with our sales team a couple of weeks ago. I think just having, and so do all of my executives. So having that open culture and everybody can talk to anybody. I don't like the hierarchy involved in corporate America. And in fact, I have never spent time in corporate America, so I can't really talk about that. But I guess that gives me a very, you know, open mind in terms of how to build a company. I just want to treat people like I would want to be treated. So that's part of it. And I think it's always starts from the top. Other things, you know, that make us unique are things like open time off. I don't want people worrying about how much time off they have, you know, accrued. I don't want them to worry about people in the hospital and they can't take the time off. So that just de-stressing people in the organization, you know, I think is really helpful in keeping that culture open and innovative.
So will you, I just want to stop for a second, because the whole time off thing, particularly in the US, I think is such a point of contention. I was just having a conversation yesterday with someone who said, I have 2 weeks off and I'm on day 8 of it already. Like they were very much being kept track of. I don't think they would have done it if they had to, but yeah. How does that kind of stuff, so not tracking days off, allowing people to be more flexible, having this open workspace, how do you think that actually helps you as a company innovate and beat your competitors, I guess?
Well, I think there's a big part around retention of employees. I mean, I think people like to hear, you know, take as much time as you need. Don't be a jerk. Do great work. It's a very simple concept. Who knew? And so I think people, you know, one of our values at Malwarebytes is no BS. And so that's exemplifying that value. Like, just, we don't care. Don't be a jerk. Do great work. And you know, we're going to support you in all of your life's events. And people have highs and lows, and I think that helps with retention, just sticking true to that value. So, you know, as I can keep people longer, they can help innovate. They get comfortable in the company. They understand the company better. They understand our customers better. Whereas if I'm turning them over, you know, maybe I get some interesting new perspectives, but I don't really have that stability. So I think that's a big part of it. you know, I think having an open culture, people can come to their boss with ideas. They can, you know, submit them formally into the Idea Bytes piece as well. But you know, if you fear your boss, you're not going to be open. You're going to shut down. You're just going to do your job and do it well and go home every day. And where does innovation come out of that?
So I'm assuming that nobody's really exploited the whole take as much time off, right? Nobody's taken 3-4 months off at a time at your company.
Not that directly. I think people have done, you know, substantial time, but they were people that were performing well. And so there's,
so
you know, obviously, yeah, there's tolerance to that.
Well,
now, and it goes back to don't be a jerk, right? So yes, we're an open culture, but everybody's looking at you too, right? So you got to perform. And if you are, then does it matter how long you're, if you work from home that day, does it matter if you're not in the office?
No, I don't think so. As someone who works both from home and the office, no. but the reason I was kind of asking that question is I know that there's some of us out there who are thinking, oh no, I would never do that because people will take advantage of it. It's kind of like free food in the cafeteria. I wouldn't do that because everyone will stop, you know, they'll eat us out of house and home if we do that. And particularly with vacation days. And to me, that's really leading from fear versus trusting that your employees are doing what they say they're going to do. And you know if they're not. So it's not like you don't check people, right? There's accountability. But there's a big difference in what you're saying, which is leading from a place of like, let's do our best together versus a place of fear, which is, oh, no, you have to track that stuff and make sure everybody's accountable for that stuff. And, you know, so it's almost focusing on the wrong things and for the wrong reasons.
Well, and you've already sized me up, so I'll admit, you know, this was definitely a learn by doing kind of experience. You know,
yeah.
When we first proposed this idea, everybody around me was like, "Oh boy, how's this going to go?" I said, "Let's see." So
yeah.
You kind of get me by now.
So no, I'm on to you, Marcin. I'm on to you. So how do you think about in your? Because I come from the same place. I'd love to hear how you wrap your head around this. In your ability and desire to test stuff out, like, let's see what happens. Let's try this. Let's do this. How do you think about risk and failure and reward? Because with every test comes, right, outcomes.
Yeah, we're in an industry where, you know, lives aren't necessarily at risk. I mean, they are and they aren't. You know, if we do something with our product that may take down a very mission critical system, that's bad. But I'm not launching humans into space, right? I'm not.
Right. You're not a brain surgeon.
Exactly. I'm not doing brain surgery. So that allows us to take more risk than many other companies can potentially. And there's also a proliferation of just awesome software out there that lets you, you know, bifurcate user experiences and really get analysis around it. So, you know, if there is harm done, it's to just a small set of customers and we can go wrap our arms around them and apologize profusely and help them. And I mean, there's a lot of different ways we can assume that risk. So I think we're in a fortunate position to be able to test things pretty rapidly on subsets of users. If there's cool ideas that we just gut feeling we think are going to work, I mean, there's no harm in trying it. And if we have to roll it back, we all did it with the assumption that we may have to. So setting expectations, I think, is also important. You know, open time off, when we rolled that out in the organization, we said, we may have to go back, but let's try it and see how it goes. And it went well. And here we are 3 years later with open time off. So there is a, you know, we have this passion for some risk. I don't think we're, you know, just doing things recklessly. And as long as there's a good case for it, we're willing to try it.
So here's my, in all honesty, pull back the curtain question, because I think this is the part that people struggle with the most. When something doesn't work as planned, as you'd like, what is your culture and process around that? And I'm not thinking specifically ABC. I'm just trying to understand, how do you really handle things that don't work? Because I think you've seen a lot of people give lip service to failure's okay. We're okay with failure here. But, and I don't even love to call it failure because it's not always that, but that's kind of the word most people use. But in reality, right, they're set up to really have unfortunate consequences if whatever they push forward doesn't work, which ultimately keeps people from actually saying anything.
Yeah, it's a tough one. And I wish I had a perfect answer. And, you know, I wish I had acted aggressively every time something had failed and rolled it back. Sometimes, you know, we don't. And sometimes, and of course, we can always do better and we should do better. I'll give you a good example. We've made organizational changes over the last 10 years and I've brought in people and maybe they necessarily weren't the right people, or maybe the org, structure wasn't right anymore. You know, maybe I think we were maybe slow in some of that stuff. So that was a big risk to take. And we were assessing, we knew maybe it wasn't the right outcome. And it took a while to roll that back. So, you know, those are always, always tough. I think just staying honest with yourself is, and asking yourself, is this working every once in a while or even more frequently, and knowing what the plan is to roll it back or pivot again. I think that's, you know, comes with the learn by doing mentality.
So, and Marcin, what I'm hearing you say, which I think is such an important lesson for us, or at least I should say what I'm hearing you not say, is here's how people suffer consequences, right? When things, you're kind of focused on the process and the product. I mean, you moved it forward with the best intention. So when something doesn't work, right, it's fair to say that you're not looking at the person like, well, you screwed up and now it's time to put you on a smaller initiative.
Exactly. But I'll give you an even better example, perhaps.
Yeah.
Every day we're taking risks just by going through an interview process with people, right? You spend an hour, maybe two, if you're lucky, with a candidate that you're bringing into the company. And at best, I mean, the odds are 50-50 in your favor that this person is going to work out. And yet that's a pretty normal risk every company takes and shrugs off every single day, right? We hire hundreds of people a year. We've spent only an hour with them, bringing them into the organization, and we're like, this is going to work great.
Right.
But that's an acceptable risk. Companies are hiring people all of the time, right? So, and doing as best they can to assess. So I really think that's a great example of just the risks that we take every day that are actually pretty serious risks. And so I think we always need to reflect, you know, is that person the right person? And I will never judge, you know, one of my hiring managers for making a bad decision, because I empathize. I too have hired people that I've spent an hour with and didn't work out. And really, the quality of the person that's hiring is whether they, you know, realize that quickly enough to put that person into a better role suited for them, or you know, transition them to a different company. I mean, that's the reality of the world.
I'd never really realized until you put it into kind of those terms, how much risk we take hiring people and how little we spend doing it most of the time.
Yeah, next time you're interviewing, you're going to be like, oh man, 50-50.
Well, I remembered, right? Totally. I'm like, it's like Russian roulette. I remember ages ago when I was working for another company, I was a VP there, and we did this top grading approach, which is these 3-4 hour interviews multiple times. And I remember being so annoyed that I had to invest all this time in an interview. And at the end of the day, the people that went through that interview and made it stayed. And oftentimes now, right, I'm like, rush, meet the person for an hour. Did they send a thank you card? Okay, good. They're hired. Right. That's my one question. Like, if you don't send a thank you card, you're out.
And if you're a startup, I mean, on one hand, you want to have the best of the best. So you should be investing 20 hours of your time, you know, hiring one person and getting your team involved and so on. On the other hand, you also don't have necessarily the luxury of all of the greatest talent out there, because not everybody's, you know, a risk taker that wants to work for a startup. And
right,
you don't really have the luxury of time either. You need somebody now.
Yeah. So you're making an excellent point there. In your work, what do you think stops? I want to ask this question on two levels, because you're in such an industry and category. One, what stops individuals from innovating? And two, you've made several references to kind of your business has a very that's the way it's always been done mentality. What stops the industry from innovating? So I think they're probably two separate answers, but just to put them both out there.
So specifically in cybersecurity, I think there just wasn't a need necessarily. You know, customers were just living with a pain. And even in this industry, you'll never get to 100% efficacy. And so it's really the tolerance of that pain. You know, how is it tolerated by our customers? Mm. That's become more aggressive nowadays because there are more competitors and each are pitching against each other. But I just think there wasn't really a need for innovation. I mean, look at taxi cabs, you know, now severely disrupted 5 years ago, but for the 40 years prior to that or more, I mean, they were same taxi cabs. There wasn't really a need for innovation. So I think some of it has also been a catalyst. So in the last 5 years, more and more devices have become internet enabled. More and more severe threats have been out there. People are actually going after cities and banks and so on. So I think now more than ever that innovation spark has arrived. But before that, there just wasn't a need.
And what about for individuals? When you see, whether that's in your company or others, what stops them from innovating?
comfort. You know, people don't like change. I don't like change. I force myself to change because I know that it could be better. It could be faster. It could be easier. But I think comfort is really maybe the primary reason for that. I really do hate change. But I like to learn by doing, which is pretty interesting. So I aspire to see if there's a better way to do it. But at the end of the day, you know, I like working with certain people, but maybe they're not the right fit. I like the house I live in, but maybe it's too far from work, right? I hate change. And I think that's probably the comfort that people feel.
How do you, for those of us who love the comfort side, but we're in so many ways, I think we're all forced into changing right now because things are moving so quickly and disruption is happening to everybody in all industries. It's not, you know, one in particular. And it's not one industry at a time, right? Based on the environment, it's all of us. What have you done to help you move and take action on change?
Definitely get out of my comfort zone and always ask the question, you know, can it be better? Can it be faster? Can it be easier for myself, for our customers, for our employees? And I like to talk to people. So I have an open door policy, not that I have a door.
But that's what I say. You don't even sit in the same place every day.
Exactly. Well, now I do for periods of time, but I flock. I'm a nomad in the organization. I think, you know, talking to people and being open that I'm looking for ideas on how to change the company and be better. Because if we're the same company today and in 2 years, we're not going to be around. I think that change needs to happen. I also like the analogy of, you know, let's just improve the company 1% every day. It's hard to figure out how to necessarily do that. But if you improve the company by 1% every day, you're a 3 times better company by the end of the year. Right. And so that's a pretty monumental challenge, but it doesn't feel like that if you're just doing 1% a day.
You know, it's I had this visual in my head and hopefully I can articulate it well because I love that 1% concept and we follow that at Launch Street too. Just actually ours is 2%, but it's just which ultimately ends up being the same thing, which is right, tiny little improvements and innovations every single day. But if you actually watch two people walking down a field and one person changed their trajectory by 1% to the right every single time, they'd end up way off in a different place by the end than the person going straight.
That's great.
And yeah. And it's hopefully I said that clearly, but I think what you're saying is highly valuable. And for all of us to think about how do we innovate 1% a day? Because that's not that hard to do. That's actually pretty easy. Like, how do we make this a little bit better, a little bit easier, a little bit more convenient, a little different? So I appreciate that you share that because I think it's a really powerful way of driving improvement and innovation every day in a way that doesn't seem scary to people.
Well, if I could just run 1% more every day, I'll be running marathons here soon.
I've done marathons. That's exhausting.
I got to get started first.
Right. It's that first mile that's the hardest, it turns out.
That's right.
I want to just ask you a quick question before we kind of run out of time about your leadership style, because as you're talking, I know we've been talking about innovation and malware bytes and all that, but what's really come out of this interview for me is that you've got a really open leadership approach. And I'm guessing that you talk to a lot of different people in the office a lot. When you think about great leadership, what do you think makes that possible, makes that happen? And part of the reason I'm asking is because I think, you know, whether you're a company of 5, 800 or 800,000, leadership really matters in setting the tone for everybody else.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of servant leadership. So, you know, my primary charter here is to make every employee the best possible so that they can make my company the best possible. And it's unique being a founder and, you know, not ever going through corporate America. I have a very different perspective. Again, back to treating people the way I want to be treated. I also have no stake in this. I'm not looking for promotion. I'm not looking for more money.
Right.
I don't, at the end of the day, I don't care who's right. I care what's right for our customers and for our company and for our employees. So it's just a different mentality. And I think anybody really can approach things with that mentality. And it really is liberating in some ways where you're just trying to make the company better. And what's it going to take to do that? And who cares who's right, who's wrong? And you know, my people are my best assets. Why would I not invest in them? Why would I not, you know, hear from them, listen to them? I mean, that's really the mentality I have, the leadership I exude, I suppose.
Well, I really appreciate that. And I will say that I'm a little bit baffled sometimes when I meet people and You know, they've got a very siloed view of who's valuable and who's not. And in my head, I'm thinking to myself, that's millions of dollars that you're saying is not that worthwhile. Why would you pay those people if that's how you feel?
Yeah.
And ultimately, yeah. And ultimately, it's not because they shouldn't be paying them. It's because they're not actually tapping them. It's a leadership problem, not a people problem in that case. But it's always fascinating to me. So thank you for answering that, because I wanted to understand. Before we have to wrap up, where can people go to learn more and connect with you?
Sure. So as I said, you know, take the challenge, take the Malwarebytes challenge. You can go to malwarebytes.com and do a free download and see what's on your computer, and we'll fix it for free. Connect with me on LinkedIn if you're an entrepreneur and looking for advice, and happy to keep in touch.
So am I accurate in saying that when I do this, chances are there's stuff on there that I don't even know?
Could be Windows or Mac or even Android.
Oh, it freaks me out when I start to think about that.
Take the challenge.
I'm doing it. I'm doing it right when we get off the phone. I'm telling you, like, I'm totally all over it. So the last question I have for you is, what's the first step we should be taking to innovate in our work? I mean, when I think, just really quickly, when I think about you, like, your first step was getting a virus and then being like, oh, I'm gonna have to figure out how to fix that. But what can we do?
Well, I think it's assessing where the pain in your life is, and always asking, how can this be better? How can this be easier? How can this be faster? Mm-hmm. And good ideas typically come out of, you know, out of solving those pain points. And what you'll find is others have similar pain points. And so talking to those people and, you know, spitballing those ideas and seeing what comes out of it, I think is a great place to start innovating.
All right. I have a little bit of a tangent question for you as you said that, because sometimes I get sent a lot of stuff to look at. Is like, oh my God, check out my product idea. And sometimes they're brilliant and surprising. And sometimes I think you're the only one that wants this, you know, and that happens. So we have a frustration, but it's not really big enough. How do you assess whether that moment of, oh, I could solve this frustration is worth pursuing? And I guess more importantly, that other people will pay you for it.
Well, I think you answered that question, which is, you know, does anybody else care?
Yeah.
I think that's the, you know, what hurts me and does anybody else care? I guess that's the follow-up.
Right.
So, and it's as simple as that, is just, you know, really understanding how big of a pain point is this. And investors will tell you, people like you and I will tell you, I think getting feedback on the idea and not just building it in a silo first is crucial. Otherwise, you're just wasting your time.
Yeah, I think that's really valuable advice. So for Launch Street out there, go test with other people who are not your family, because they will not tell you the truth.
Yeah.
And go download Malwarebytes and see what's going on with your computer. So Marcin, thank you so much. I feel like we covered a lot of different ground around kind of innovating and not just launching a company, but really staying a leader, and then your own leadership approach. So thanks for those insights.
Likewise. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh my gosh. Viruses, cybersecurity. What an amazing industry. Although frankly, my favorite part is still Marcin's opening story about solving a problem he created. Unintentionally, of course, but he created it himself. It just makes me think, are there problems out there that maybe even we're creating that we could solve because other people are having those problems too? And if we did that, we would add a ton of value and solutions to all of us. Tamara out.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, LaunchStreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.